This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new text line here in Wisconsin is providing free advice and resources for parents of young kids. One of the program's directors tells us how it works. Now, the United States and China have been engaged in a back and forth in recent weeks over their relationships with Taiwan. China launched military drills after publicly condemning a meeting between House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen in California earlier this month. The Taiwanese leader highlighted the significance of the tensions for her country.
It is no secret that today, the peace that we have maintained and the democracy which have worked hard to build are facing unprecedented challenges. We once again find ourselves in a world where democracy is under threat, and the urgency of keeping the beacon of freedom shining cannot be understated.
Our next guest is watching these events and joins us now for a look at what's at stake, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. First, what questions do you have about what's going on, the status of Taiwan? What do you think of China's response to U.S. relations with the country? Are you worried about escalating conflict there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Oriana Schuyler-Mastro is a Center Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, where her research focuses on Chinese military and security policy. She's also a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of the book, The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace Talks in Wartime. Oriana, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about the strange status of China and Taiwan. In effect, in practice, they're two separate countries. In U.S. foreign policy, there's one China, but there's also kind of Taiwan. And according to the Chinese, of course, it's one country. Can you untangle that for us a little bit?
Sure. So this is a very complex issue. Basically, the United States originally recognized the government that was in Taiwan as the legitimate government of all of China. This was after the Civil War and the communists won, Mao Zedong won in 1949. And the nationalists who the United States had been supporting, because we were very, you know, fighting communism back then, they fled to Taiwan. And so we recognized that as the government of China. Flash forward to the 1970s, the United States sees an opportunity to side with China against the Soviet Union. And so through the process of normalizing relations with the PRC, the People's Republic of China, that communist government, the United States had to abrogate a defense treaty it had with Taiwan and cut off official relations. At that point, we still had, and we still continue to have, interactions with the island of Taiwan, right? People can go there. People from Taiwan come to study in the United States. There's commercial interests. And so there was something called the Taiwan Relations Act, which set up the legal framework for these types of interactions. So since then, the United States policy, and this stems all the way back to the normalization of relations with the PRC in the 1970s, is that we recognize that Chinese on both sides of the strait, so in Taiwan and in mainland China, believe there is but one China and Taiwan is part of it. So the United States doesn't take a position on it. The United States position is just, we know that you believe that. And that kind of ambiguity has worked for U.S. policy for the past couple of decades.
Also part of the U.S. role in Taiwan, though, we sell them some defensive military armaments and help to prepare for a feared Chinese invasion today. How big a deal is U.S. support for Taiwan, even behind that ambiguity you were talking about?
So this was originally a part of the Taiwan Relations Act, which Congress passed in 1979. The commitment was to continue to supply Taiwan with arms of a defensive nature. The view was that in order to avoid a war over the Taiwan Strait, it was important that the PRC, or the People's Republic of China, didn't think that they could take Taiwan by force. If they did, then they might try to, and then we might have a war on our hands. So the idea was to deter any sort of attempts. Taiwan had to have sufficient self-defense capabilities. At this time, the United States was also concerned about a Taiwan attack on mainland China. I know that seems crazy now, but up and through the year 2000, the Taiwan military was stronger than that of China's. And so it was also important for the United States only to sell Taiwan articles of defensive nature. So as also not to encourage the government of Taiwan to attack mainland China. So this is a key component of U.S. policy over Taiwan. And it's really elevated in its importance in recent months as people become concerned that the Chinese military will soon have the capability to take Taiwan by force. It's become even more important that Taiwan has an ability to defend itself.
And let's get into the recent months now. Was just last year, then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. China reacts with military exercises. Now, the president of Taiwan, as I mentioned, meets in the U.S. with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. China responds with military exercises. What do you make of the Chinese military drills? What do they mean?
So I think they have two purposes. I think the one most people focus on is this signaling component, right? China is just telling the world, and in particular the United States, that they are unhappy with how things have gone. So they do military exercises to express their discontent. But I think the deeper purpose, and why I wouldn't necessarily say that it is a reaction to the visits from first Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan and then President Tsai's visit with Speaker McCarthy, is because the Chinese military has to do these exercises to prepare their own capabilities. And internally, they talk about the need to prepare and to do these exercises. So we know the one that they launched in August, for example, they'd already had that on the books. They were going to do it a bit later, but then they decided to do it a bit earlier so it could serve these dual purposes. So the primary reason China does these exercises is to improve its own military capabilities, to increase its options to potentially use force against the island of Taiwan.
Talking to Oriana Schuyler-Mastro from Stanford University, looking at China, Taiwan, and the United States. What's at stake with what appear to be, once again, escalating tensions? You could join in with your questions, your thoughts on this, what you want the U.S. role to be, if any. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oriana, can you talk about what's at stake for the United States? I know we rely on Taiwan for a lot of high-tech products. We rely on China for a lot of consumer goods, sometimes produced in factories owned, I believe, by Taiwanese businesses. Disruptions there could have a big impact on us here, right?
So I think we have to separate out. There are many rational reasons why this could affect the United States. As you mentioned, the most advanced semiconductors are produced in Taiwan. These go into basically all of our electronic equipment, cars, basically everything we use these days. And separate from just Taiwan and even our trade with China, which is immense, if there were a conflict in the region, that would basically shut down trade for the duration of the conflict, if not indefinitely, if the United States and China then engage in a hostile relationship with one another. But I think it's important to point out that there is an emotional component of this, both for Taiwan and China and the United States. The Chinese government and the Chinese people really believe this is part of China's territory. And for the United States, it's really important for Asia to remain a peaceful and prosperous place because the majority of U.S. interests that are outside of the United States are in Asia. And if the United States government cannot protect our interests there, then that becomes very problematic for the everyday lives of Americans. So it also goes much deeper than just the statistics of trade and commerce and our technological reliance, which is all, of course, there.
And part of the reason, I think, for American sympathies with Taiwan, you've got the government in mainland China, extremely authoritarian, communist government, getting more authoritarian, I think, if that's possible, under the current leader there. Taiwan, which had been kind of an authoritarian nationalist government, as I understand it, now what appears to be a functioning electoral democracy. These are two very different societies and governments now.
Exactly. So it depends on who you ask. For some people, Taiwan is important for economic and technological reasons. For others, it's important for the United States to be protecting democracies around the world, of which Taiwan is one of them. And then, of course, there's the broader issue of the United States maintaining its posture in Asia so that it can protect its allies and partners, but also its own interests. So I think there's an array of different reasons why the United States cares about this issue. But for an individual American, it might depend on what their own viewpoints are.
Talking to Oriana Skylar-Mastro from Stanford University, looking at the tensions between China and Taiwan and how the U.S. and other Western powers have responded. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the threat of a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan or escalating tensions leading to an outbreak of war without intention in the first place? What, if anything, do you want to see the United States do to prevent that war, to respond if it should happen? We'll get into some of those issues. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Oriana Skylar-Mastro, Center Fellow at Stanford University, non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, looking at what's at stake with rising tensions between China and Taiwan. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, what you want to see from the Biden administration when it comes to Taiwan and China. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bill is with us in Barnes. Bill, hello.
Hello. Excellent program today, both segments.
Thanks.
The iconic scene in Dirty Harry where he asked the guy, were you counting my shots? Did I shoot five or six? China's counting how many cylinders we've emptied, keeping Ukraine supplied, and finding out that we've got about a year's worth of ammunition. I'd like her comments on that calibration that China is making, and if they feel emboldened, if they're feeling lucky with how much ammunition the United States stockpiled.
Interesting question, Bill, and a well-expressed movie metaphor along the way. Oriana, what do you think?
So the short answer is yes. I kind of discount the role of Ukraine only because we were in such a bad position before Ukraine. You're absolutely right, Bill. Like, now we're in a worse position. But even before Ukraine, the United States just hasn't been focused on in the defense industry necessary to produce massive amounts of munitions. And so it was always a concern of the U.S. military that if we got into a major war with China, that we would run out of a lot of our most important munitions. You said, you know, I think you said a matter of months or years, but it's you know, in some cases, it's a matter of days, if not weeks. And so one of the big issues right now is to try to figure out how to rethink how we approach these issues so that we can stockpile more munitions, some of which, you know, are necessary to sell to Taiwan for their own self-defense, but some of which the United States also needs to improve our maneuverability in various conflicts.
Bill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Oriana, I won't ask you to predict the future, but as you weigh, you know, what might lead to a Chinese decision to launch an invasion of Taiwan, what kind of things do you look at?
So I think one of the important things from my perspective is how different this is from Ukraine, and in particular, how different Xi Jinping, the current leader of China, is from Putin. He seems to me, at least in my study of Chinese behavior and activities and leadership discourse, to be a very pragmatic individual. Right now, there is a threat that he might decide to use force against Taiwan because he believes that he could take Taiwan easily and with minimal cost. And this is largely because the international community, while impressively have sanctioned Russia, is very reliant on China. And the majority of leaders that are China's number one trading partners have expressed to China in a variety of ways that they wouldn't sanction China to the same degree. For example, China's number one trading partner is the European Union. And we've recently seen, even amidst all this tension in Ukraine, European leaders like the French leader Macron go to Beijing, right? A lot of them are paid pilgrimage. And so if China were to face severe economic costs, for example, states were going to stop and cease all trade with China indefinitely if they attacked Taiwan, that cost would be too high. Also, if China had to fight, you know, multi-year war, protracted war against the United States, that would also be too high. But right now, the situation is such that it's possible that they could take Taiwan quickly before the United States can even mount a serious defense. And if, you know, the government of Taiwan capitulates and there are limited casualties, it's possible that the international response won't be so severe. And so because of this, it might be tempting for Xi Jinping to do it. But if the United States improved its military force posture, or if U.S. allies and partners were willing to support Taiwan's self-defense to a greater degree, whether that be militarily or economically, then we could continue to deter conflict for at least another couple of years, if not the indefinite future.
And then there's the risk of an accidental start to a conflict if, say, China is doing military exercises closer and closer to the shores of Taiwan, the risk of a little thing breaking into a bigger thing. How much do you worry about that?
So I do not worry about that at all, but I'm in a minority opinion on that. I think, you know, this inadvertent escalation narrative is something that's very American, the idea that wars happen by accident. And it largely stems from the narratives after World War I and World War II, in which no one could possibly believe that so many people had died and there was such global devastation. And that was the result of decision makers, you know, decisions. It had to have happened somehow by accident. In the case of China, Taiwan is their most important issue. The Chinese government is not going to make a move on Taiwan, short of course, Taiwan declaring independence. They're not going to initiate something unless the conditions are perfectly ideal for them. And part of that is that the United States isn't paying such close attention, right? If we're in the middle of a crisis, so the United States has surged some forces into the region, we're conducting extra patrols, that is not the best time to try to take Taiwan before anyone notices. And so if some sort of incident happens or some sort of collision, basically, unless the Chinese believe that it's an ideal time for them to take Taiwan, they are not going to escalate it to the level of warfare. And at least in Chinese military writings, they talk very extensively about at least their confidence in their ability to control that type of escalation and that type of decision.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hi.
Hi, Rob. Would Americans gladly give up Taiwan if it would thwart a war on our soil with China?
Tony, thanks for the call. Ariana, the interest of Americans in going to war with China or giving up Taiwan to avoid such a war?
So I'll make two points for Tony. The first one is China currently does not have a conventional military capability against the United States. So this war we're talking about, when we talk about a war between China and the United States, we're talking about this happening in the Taiwan Strait, not really happening on U.S. soil. The United States has the ability to attack China because we have ships and airplanes that are in close proximity to China. We have bases around China, but China does not have that capability against us. So they can basically hurt the United States directly, the homeland of the United States, you know, cyber attacks, attacking our space assets, or of course, nuclear war, which is obviously an escalation much higher than just the war we're talking about today. The second point I would make is, and this seems like an obvious one, it's very easy to avoid a war. It is always an option to avoid a conflict if you give the other side everything they want. I think the issue is that what China wants is something that is too threatening to U.S. security and U.S. interests. And so I think the viewpoint is that hopefully the decision would be made to prevent rewarding that type of Chinese aggression. But of course, it's not even just against the U.S. homeland, but the Americans that are in the region, the U.S. military. There will be severe casualties if U.S. forces and Chinese forces head to head. And for that reason, a lot of people are, you know, questioning whether or not those costs are going to be too high for the United States to bear. So that's also part of the reason we want to be more prepared, because the stronger our military is, the less those costs will be, and then the more likely we are to defend Taiwan in a contingency.
Tony, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Oriana, can you talk about the alternatives to war? I mean, we have this sort of pretend scenario where everybody agrees that there's one China, but there's really two Chinas. Can we just maintain that status quo for indefinitely?
So to be clear, the United States would love to maintain that status quo, definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, when I talk to my Chinese colleagues and they complain about U.S. policies, you know, I say we can have a different interpretation about who is actually changing or maintaining the status quo. But one thing is certain, and that's for the United States, the current situation is the ideal one. While for China, the current situation is not the ideal one. Xi Jinping has been very clear that he is dissatisfied and that he wants to see, in his words, progress towards reunification with Taiwan. And so part of the reason this has come up in the headlines is not so much that the United States wants to see anything different, but it's become very clear that the Communist Party in mainland China wants to see something different. And so that has unleashed some panic about what that difference might be and how China might be willing to achieve it.
Time for one more quick call. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. China and Russia were cooperating on propaganda efforts, I heard recently, to sort of try to excuse each of one their actions. Also, based on your last point, I was going to throw in that Taiwan's done a very good job of taking care of its citizens. And part of the reason China may want it is because it doesn't want to be embarrassed by that.
Nate, interesting points. Just a minute or so, Oriana, for your response.
So that's a typical argument, not only about Taiwan, but also about South Korea, Japan, other democracies around its borders. You know, I wish that were true, and maybe it was more true maybe 30 years ago, but at least the Chinese government does believe that they have a model that is better for development and is better for stability, and they don't necessarily look over at the United States and see us as an example of how they want to be, or even Taiwan in some respects. So I think there's a possibility there, and it's very important, therefore, that we continue in the United States, improve in our own national experiment and improve our own resiliency and our own efforts at achieving, you know, a good, solid democratic system. So that's part of it, but I don't think it holds as much weight as potentially it did a couple decades ago.
Thanks for that call, Nate. And Oriana, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Oriana Skylar-Mastro, Center Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She was with us today to look at China's response to U.S. meetings with Taiwan and growing tensions in that area and what's at stake. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, find out how an expanded network of weather stations is trying to make crucial up-to-the-minute forecasts more accessible to communities around Wisconsin and to farmers around Wisconsin. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30. That's here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, as they say, parenting doesn't come with an instruction manual, but now it can come with free advice and guidelines right to your phone. A new text service is available in Wisconsin to help parents and caregivers with the challenges of raising children. The United Way of Wisconsin recently announced a partnership with Bright by Text. That service provides free info and advice about pregnancy and about raising children through age 8. It was released earlier this month in connection with the National Association for the Education of Young Children's annual Week of the Young Child. Rebecca Levy is the Program and Systems Director for Bright by Text. She works directly on this partnership with United Way of Wisconsin. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. How does Bright by Text work?
Yes, Bright by Text is a national texting platform. We curate content from national trusted experts to support a whole child, whole family approach to early childhood. With that, we are just really committed to contributing to a world in which every child and family can thrive. And so that's why through our text messages, we share helpful information and activities on topics such as physical and mental health, social emotional well-being, safety, brain development, connections, encouragement, and more.
So if I'm a parent who signs up, my kids are a little past the age range here, but if I was a parent who signed up, like how much am I going to be flooded with texts? What is the information flow like?
Absolutely. So we have a couple of different content streams. The first is what I just described, those curated content messages, which are delivered based on the child's date of birth down to age of life. So a parent taking care of a 206-day-old baby versus a 500-day-old baby will receive different messages. And then we also partner with organizations like the United Way of Wisconsin to bring local resources, services, and information to parents and caregivers as well. And so we're able to really collaborate on a local level to ensure that families are getting information on library story times, on diaper banks, community baby showers, food banks, and more.
Can you talk a little bit about the sources of information? Where do you go to get good quality vetted information for parents?
Yeah. So we start by looking at, again, national content contributors who already have really valuable resources and materials for families with young children. And then we work with them to develop that content into translating it into text messaging. So we will, a parent or caregiver would receive about 2 messages per week. You get a text message, and then there is a linked landing page so that our parents and caregivers can really choose the level of information that they want to receive. If a 140-character text is enough to get the information, that's great. But if they want to click and get even more resources and understand why that particular topic is important, we have that available as well. And so once we identify who those content contributors could be, we work with them. So we've worked with Nurse Family Partnership, CBS Learning Media, No Kid Hungry. We've worked with 0-3. We recently have started working with Destination Imagination, Big Heart World, really thinking about those social emotional topics.
We're talking to Rebecca Levy with Bright by Text about a program new here in Wisconsin where parents can sign up for these parenting texts related to the age of their kid. Now, Rebecca, this is brand spanking new here in Wisconsin, but it's been operating for quite a while in other states. What kind of impact and response have you been getting?
Yeah, so Bright by Text actually evolved out of a traditional home visitation program that was operated very successfully here in Colorado, where we're headquartered, for over 25 years. And we really just wanted to move, we wanted to respond to parents and caregivers where they're at. And we knew that we could leverage this idea of nudge behavior change and doing that through your cell phone. And so in other states where we've operated for several years, we have subscriber recorded benefits. We like to call them our 3 C's, to see how those Bright by Text messages are nudging their behavior, are improving their connections with their child. So we know that 95% of our parents and caregivers indicate that Bright by Text has helped them feel more confident and informed about their child's development. 87% have tried a positive parenting behavior as a result of receiving one of our text messages. And then we also know, again, that local component, 68% report that they have actually connected with their community.
This goes through age 8. Is there a thought of expanding into tween or even teen years in the future?
We definitely get asked that, once a parent or caregiver is getting these helpful information, tips, resources, they want it to go on. And so we currently offer prenatal, so the second trimester of pregnancy through age 8, really getting past that school readiness, as well as when a child transitions from learning to read to reading to learn. And so I think we are through age 8 for the time being, but expanding is not off the table.
And Rebecca, as we wrap up, if there's a parent out there listening saying, I'm in, how do they get on board?
Yeah, so this is a free service for parents and caregivers. And to sign up in Wisconsin, you can text the keyword BADGER, B-A-D-G-E-R, to 27448. And if you ever forget that number, when you look at your cell phone, those numbers actually spell out bright on your phone pad.
Rebecca, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And we are so excited to bring this service to families across Wisconsin.
That's Rebecca Levy, Program and Systems Director for Bright by Text. She was with us today to share her organization's new partnership with United Way of Wisconsin to bring their parenting advice text service to the state. Again, you could sign up for Bright by Text by texting the word Badger. How are we going to remember that? Badger. And the number is 274-448. Again, 274-448. As we just heard, that spells out Bright on your phone. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Maureen McCollum with a pair of stories about Good Samaritans.
We're living in a time when things feel so polarized. Us versus them. I'm right, you're wrong. But writer and cardiologist Dr. R.F. Ahmed of Madison wants to remind people there's so much good in the world and that we should take care of one another. He shares two writings about Good Samaritans in his life.
My Jesus Moment, May 2020. A routine plays out at my place of work year after year. I call it my Jesus Moment. Every year, I fast during Ramadan. For those not sure, this is a Muslim tradition of no eating or drinking from pre-dawn to sunset for a month straight. It is a spiritual and physical cleansing and reckoning of sorts. Kathy, a colleague of mine, is an excellent pastry chef, a baker par excellence. That she is Christian and married to a pastor adds a little more oomph to this storyline. For years now, I would do the fasting and Kathy would bake a cake and other confectionery for the department to celebrate the end of Ramadan. I bear the brunt for the good of many. My Jesus Moment. We get a laugh out of it. Even more, in the world of today, I derive hope out of this. A gift early in the pandemic, April 2020. A world in lockdown, I step out every day to fight an enemy I cannot see. I arm myself by giving to those worse hit than me. I wear my destiny and well wishes and acts of kindness such as these. A gift of hand-sewn caps and masks from my neighbor. Thank you, Bonnie Kenzie.
R.F. Ahmed shared his writings about Good Samaritans in Wisconsin. He also told me why he wanted to pair those stories together.
It is my observation that places where people treat each other well, those nations, communities, and places generally are doing well, and vice versa. Places, nations, communities where people mistreat each other, abuse each other, are not doing so well. So I can extend this a little further. And all religions talk about being a good Samaritan and being rewarded for that. And for abusers, there's punishment. And then when I look around, I see this happening in real time where places with more good Samaritan are getting rewarded and places with more abusers are getting punished. And this, to me, is a sign that God is.
Why do you think it's important to share stories about kindness?
I believe because kindness plays into our happiness. Optimism plays into our mental and physical well-being. And I think it is critical to bring about more of those subjects. One of my writings in the book is actually a critique on the news, which I sometimes feel takes the negative perspective and puts it above the positive take. So I think the positive take, this is the best of America for you in these readings, and I wanted to lay it out.
Dr. R.F. Ahmed is a writer and cardiologist from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, tap into your creative side with advice from Wisconsin's own Linda Berry. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, where do you get your inspiration from? What does it take to get your creativity going? Our next guest has explored those questions in her own award-winning art and is helping students in Wisconsin find answers through her own work. Linda Berry is the creator of Ernie Pook's Comic, a comic strip that ran for 30 years. She's the author of the award-winning book Making Comics. In 2019, she received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant. She's a professor of interdisciplinary creativity at UW-Madison and the 2023 Artist-in-Residence at Beloit College. I talked to her earlier this year. I want to start with something that I learned from talking to you a long time ago. I think in our lives a lot, we outsource creativity to the, you know, the professional creatives, the artists and musicians. You are really hoping that we reclaim some of our creativity. Can you give us some encouragement to do that?
Well, you know, that's, and especially right now, I think the thing I'm the most interested in is what making drawings can be for people who gave up on drawing when they were little. Most people decide they can't draw at about, it's unfortunate, but it's at about 8 or 9 when they realize they can't draw a nose or hand. And then that's it. They just feel washed up. And for a lot of people, drawing just stops there. But one of the things I'm especially interested in is what happens if you bring drawing back in to the classroom in particular, if you bring it back in, but not with the aim of making a really good picture, but doing something like, for instance, bringing a classroom together. After, I think a lot of professors and teachers noticed that when the students came back after the pandemic break, people just had a hard time talking. They had a hard time getting together. They had a hard time just socializing in class. And I found out that if I asked them to close their eyes and draw a mermaid for 1 minute without opening their eyes, when they open their eyes, what they've drawn is so shocking and surprising and hilarious to them that the whole atmosphere of the room changes. So one of the things that people can do if they, you know, it sounds like it's not that big of a deal, but if you can close your eyes and draw something with your, draw something for 1 minute, you have to set a timer, you can't stop drawing. I always suggest that people start with a bacon and egg breakfast because everybody seems to be able to draw that with their eyes closed. And when they open their eyes, they go, hey, I got something going on. And then the mermaid's always hilarious. Statue of Liberty is really good to draw with your eyes closed. So it's all these things that you kind of think you don't know how to draw. When you close your eyes, for people who gave up drawing a long time ago, they can draw longer without stopping with their eyes closed than with their eyes open. Because with your eyes open, you start to argue, like, that doesn't look like the Statue of Liberty. With your eyes closed, you're feeling in the dark. And so that's something that I'm really interested in, how drawing can transform the mood of the room and also the person who's drawing. Like, that to me is amazing. All you do is close your eyes and wiggle your pen for a minute, and when you open your eyes, you feel I had my students draw themselves as Batman today, just doing something that they do in the morning. You're like Batman making toast or brushing their teeth with their eyes closed. And it was the same thing. It was like they all came in kind of tired. We drew ourselves as Batman with our eyes closed, and then the room was awake. So I find that amazing.
I think I see how that works because you're talking to me. I gave up drawing. I'm terrible at drawing. But if I if you said, Rob, draw something with your eyes open, I'd be like, I can't do it. If you told me, with your eyes closed, the pressure's off all of a sudden, right? Like, of course I can't draw something with my eyes closed, so yeah, I'll give it a shot. Is that the kind of response you get from this?
Well, it's actually more, it's deeper than that because you can't not first of all, feel kind of crazy when you're drawing with your eyes closed. It's sort of like me telling you to go into a dark room and feel around until you find the figurine of the cat that's in there. So if we filmed you doing that, you'd look pretty crazy. Actually, part of the reason I have people draw with their eyes closed is I just love watching people draw with their eyes closed. The whole class looks like it's dreaming, you know. But then when you open your eyes, it's a kind of surprise that's really wild because it's so different than what you thought you were drawing. And just that, to get a charge from drawing, and the drawing itself isn't that important. I mean, the drawing itself isn't, I mean, you might want to keep it, you might want to throw it away. You don't have to do anything with it. You can put it in recycling. But it's really what I've started to find out is it really is this powerful, powerful thing. And for teaching creative writing, which I also do, you can do a thing where I can read you a story, a short story, and then I'll have you close your eyes and draw a scene from it. And it doesn't seem like anybody could really do that except for everyone.
Okay.
I've almost never met anyone who can't do that.
I just did the mermaid thing with my eyes closed while you were talking. I got the hair pretty close to the head, actually.
No, that's why it's funny. It's because your eyes are closed and then you lift the pen and it's like, where's the face supposed to go? And also, is she wearing like a shell bra? Like what?
There's, I didn't
like,
get that
all
detail.
These things.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's it in a nutshell. It's just a strange little thing, but it does surprise people. Today, the other thing I had them draw with their eyes closed, which everyone can do, is a castle for 1 minute, or a cat. There are all these things that we know the shapes of, and we kind of know the outlines of, but we don't necessarily know that we know that until we give it a try.
I want to throw at you, before we run out of time, there's a line on your Tumblr blog that I really wanted to throw at you and have you expand on. You wrote on a piece of paper, drawing to have an experience rather than make a thing that is good or bad. And I don't know, that just really hit me as something really important. If we're not worried about, this is going to be a product that I'm going to like either be ashamed of or be proud to show people and do it for the experience. Can you talk about that for a couple minutes?
Sure. Like, say you go on a bike ride, right? And you go on this bike ride and you have a good bike ride and you come home and you feel like you had a really good bike ride. And then suddenly there's a knock on the door and it's the guys who drive the Google car.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, did you just take a bike ride? And you go, yes. And they say, how was it? And you go, I thought it was fantastic. And they say, well, let's review the film. So, or let's judge this bike ride by the tracks that your bicycle made. So there are two different things. One is you're in it and you're having a full body experience that actually can change your mood versus this piece of paper that tells you you either did a great job of drawing that castle or you failed. And neither of those things give you much of an experience, except for an experience of never, ever wanting to do it again, you know. So there's just something to it. And at Beloit College, that's what I'm studying along with my students, because my students, for the most part, there are creative, or they're interested in creative writing. And so what I'm trying to show them is how drawing can help get you there. And also that there's something very similar about drawing and creative writing in that they deal with images and they deal with your body. And they're very different than thinking, than trying to plan something out. It should feel a little bit like going on one of those funhouse rides at the carnival or those horror rides. there should be a little bit of terror, but a good terror in it.
Linda, yeah. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you again.
It's so wonderful, and I want to just say hi to everybody out in their cars driving home. I listen to this show all the time, and it's just I'm thrilled to think that it's my little voice coming out of people's radios right now.
Well, it's good to hear you again, Linda. Thanks so much. That's Linda Berry, creativity expert, creator of the comic strip Ernie Pook's Comique, artist and teacher at UW-Madison and Beloit College. She joined us today to explore the energy of creativity. If you are the people out there in your car, don't try that eyes closed drawing trick just yet. I'm going to keep doing this. Do you get to see my mermaid? You do not. That's pretty good. Good shot. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, do we need legal limits on social media use for kids? A Wisconsin state lawmaker makes the case that we do and shares a proposed law. And tipping can be confusing. Questions about who, when, and how much to tip. We'll look at the modern world of gratuities and how to make those decisions. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.